Good morning. We'll call this meeting to order. And happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning.
I will move House File 955 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. Mr. Chairman, members, this is a bill that simply does something I think a lot of people feel is common sense in the general public. It has been brought up to me by constituents at town meetings and other issues. And what it is what people might call a he who pays the piper calls the tune bill. In that, if the taxpayers are paying for something, they expect a good use of their tax dollar. That being said, if we have money that is coming out of the health and welfare budget, does it really make sense that we are paying for things that are to the detriment of people's health and welfare, i.e. tobacco products or cigarettes? This bill started out as a concept in what some people were in my district were bringing to me, that we don't allow, for example, food stamps or these EBT cards or whatever, to purchase tobacco products. So therefore, why would we allow MFEP money to be used or allowance on public health programs when, in essence, we're turning around and we're taking public health dollars and cash payments and helping pay for something that's not a good idea. Now, this bill is different than what was originally floated. Originally floated, people said, well, what if persons just say, hey, we don't use tobacco and you need to test for tobacco like you do when you go get... When I got my life insurance and my wife and I went in, they had us test to make sure that we were being honest in our tobacco. When we said we've never smoked a cigarette, that we actually are being honest about that we're not smokers. And so they gave us a little test, some type of an oral swab or whatever it was, came back, showed negative, and therefore our insurance premiums are a little bit lower than what they'd otherwise be. I dropped that from this bill. I think it gets a little invasive. I have a libertarian streak in me, and I think when you get to the point of testing people for something that just goes a little above and beyond the pale of what we want to do, especially if we're just going to try this out. Members, if you look at the bill, it's basically for three programs that we have, medical assistance, MFEP, and general assistance, medical care. We would have an expectation as taxpayers, as lawmakers, to set a parameter up that the person either does not use tobacco products or that they enroll in a tobacco use cessation program. I did have a handout for you members that Medicare, as of last December, there's a little email that was sent out, as of last December, Medicare is now providing for coverage for Medicare beneficiaries who smoke to receive counseling services to help them quit. And at the end of the day, this bill has some punitive measures to it if you do not get into the role of trying to quit. And if you can see on the first page of line 24, $40 per month maximum, where we're going to have people, if you've got money for cigarettes, obviously there is money laying around somewhere in your discretionary income, and we have to send a message that the taxpayers' money needs to be spent in a better fashion. It's not your money, it's the taxpayers' money. He who pays the piper calls the tune, and therefore there needs to be some semblance of a message sent. Now, if people want to get rid of that, I'm fine with that. If people want to delete sections of the bill that relate to any kind of punitive measures, the carrot and stick that I'm trying to use is that the carrot is that we're going to try to get people in the smoking cessation programs. The stick is the $40 copay or out of pocket that you would have to pay because smoking does, whether we want to acknowledge that or not, does cause more expense in the healthcare budget, both for the government and for the private sector. And I think when it comes to the taxpayers paying for this, it's not something that the average taxpayer thinks is a good use of money. With that being said, I'm not sure that a bill like this is something that can be implemented on a statewide scale as of July 1st or August 1st. It is a radical idea in some people's mind. In my opinion, it's kind of common sense, but we have differing opinions on a lot of things. That's what the legislature is all about. But what I would beg for the committee's indulgence on, and is what this committee has done in the past, is to consider perhaps removing the penalties and moving forward with perhaps a pilot project in the next year. And what I'm saying is that let's try to work with the tobacco cessation programs that are out there, and they are available in nonprofit sectors, in insurance sectors, in government sectors. You've got MPAT out there, which may or may not be using their money wisely in a lot of cases, and potentially find one or two counties that might be willing to voluntarily try this out. Get rid of the penalties potentially, but say, let's try to see if we can help people with counseling programs and smoking cessation, and in a pilot project manner, try to track and see if it's working, and forget about the penalties, if you will. And see if there's a common ground that we can find. Actually, Representative Kahn gave me some of the ideas on this. Drop the testing. It's too invasive. It's not what we're about. Think about doing a pilot project maybe in a rural county where we're not trying to swallow the whole apple, if you will. Try to find a county where we have some nonprofits set up that do smoking cessation, where the state potentially could help partner with some information. So when a person comes in to sign up, and what Representative Kahn and I had talked about was particularly for women who are pregnant, who are coming in for WIC, for example, who are thinking about prenatal programs, about really take the stick away, but try to really put forward the idea that this is really harmful to your baby, and it's not good for you either. And try to get some information out to them in terms of this not being a good thing. I am supportive of any mild effort that this committee can put forward in a pilot project, in a some type of a screening and follow-up that perhaps the Department of Health could partner with a nonprofit, and we can find a regional center that has some of the non-smoking programs available. I know in Marshall we have a very good one. I have never had the problem myself. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. I know a lot of people who have, including family members, and I don't think anybody who smokes wants to. I think in many cases it's an addiction. And if we can try to do the carrot approach of counseling, smoking cessation, the patch, the pill, the gum, or whatever it is that can help these folks out, I think in the long run, prevention will help. It's not going to be 100% successful because I think human beings by nature react differently to different programs. But at the end of the day, if we could all come up with a common idea of how can we help people, and I'm particularly, when I talk to people like Representative Kahn, particularly concerned about pregnant women, in that if we can really help them when they're on the prenatal side of things, if they are smoking, that we say, you know what, we're not going to punish you, but we really want to help you discover that this is not good for the unborn child, this is not good for your health, the secondhand smoke is not good for potentially the other children you have in your home, and we really want to do whatever means necessary that we have. As I said, whether it's the patch or the gum or the pill or the counseling or whatever it is, we're going to really try to help you do the right thing. And I see a lot of the public assistance programs that we have as a funnel to get that information to these people and to get that incentive forward. So, members, the reason I'm bringing this bill forward is more carrot than stick. I oftentimes will get labeled as I carry the club around and so forth. If we can all come to a common ground on this, and we can try this out in several spots around the state, maybe there's one metro city that we can try it in that's of a modest size. Maybe there's a couple rural counties that are not real large. We have counties that only have 5,000 people in them, and not a big caseload. But I've talked to some public health people and some people that work for human services, and they've told us if you don't go full bore with this, if you could let us try this and maybe just work with pregnant women and people who have the means to have smoking cessation programs available. Because to be honest with you, in a lot of rural areas, we don't have the counseling centers and the smoking cessation or the Department of Health. You know, we have a lot of those things in a Marshall, but if you go into an area like Lackawanna County, they probably don't have those resources available. So let's try to work together to come up with something that may seem reasonable to everybody in the legislature, and I think that's the route that we should really do. It's really an encouragement for good stewardship of our tax dollars, and I would put that for consideration before the committee in your omnibus bill. This doesn't have to go on the omnibus bill, but if we could find some common ground on something, an incentivized pilot program for pregnant women signing up for prenatal programs, I would be happier than a lark if we could do something like that. But let's try to come up with some common ground and something that makes sense. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll yield for questions or whatever testimony people want to bring forward. I would ask the people that testify to try to testify to what I spoke about, rather than the bill as it is now, per se. And if you really find this outrageous, go ahead and say that. But let's try to find common ground. I really think there are people of different ideologies that can come together on something, and let's try to do that. With that, I'll yield to questions.
Representative Mahoney, did you want to wait until the remaining testifiers completed, or did you want to ask a question right now?
Well, I think I got a question right now.
Representative Mahoney.
I was trying to read the bill. I read the bill last night, and I'm trying to listen to what you're saying. So, essentially, you said, House File 955, is you want us to tell government services to funnel people to smoking cessation programs. I mean, that's what you just told me. That's what I understand. And I'm trying to figure out what you're asking here, because I'm not tracking very well with this.
Okay, Representative Steffert.
Representative Mahoney, Mr. Chairman, what I'm trying to say is that if we have people who are coming forward to public assistance programs, and we can get, what I'm going to say is funnel people, funnel information, and try to use the incentivized approach of when you sign up for programs, we can get you into a program for counseling, and as I said, if we can work with some of the nonprofits and the MPAT people and some of those folks, particularly for IC vulnerable populations, unborn children, women who are signing up for prenatal programs, let's try to reach those populations in an aggressive way to do the right thing, not just for the taxpayers' dollars. It's, at the end of the day, this is about people's health with government money. And if we have health and welfare dollars being spent, don't you think it should be spent for the betterment of people's health and welfare? Because right now, if you get a cash check through general assistance or what have you, there's nothing to stop a person from going to the grocery store and buying tobacco with it. The original bill approach was, let's try to stop that. That's really hard to do. So what I'm trying to do is find some way of common ground of incentivizing people to get into cessation programs. If you're signing up for public assistance and you are a smoker, that you can find help. Because there are people, when I met with the Lyon County Human Services Department, there are people who go to sign up for programs who don't know that there are smoking cessation programs that can help them. And a lot of times they feel like they're going to get charged for it and so on and so forth. Let's try to figure out a way to get the information to them to say, you know what, there is help out there for you to stop.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Mahoney.
Is there someone from the Department of Health that's going to be testifying today?
Not on our list, Representative Mahoney.
Because I find it hard to believe that the Department of Health doesn't already tell people that smoking is bad for you. It's hard not to catch that. I think there's stuff in the newspaper today about, I was reading the Minneapolis paper, and I know you love the Minneapolis paper. it had stuff about overweight people. It had stuff about smoking. It had, there was another thing about health concerns. So, I mean, we see it every day. This seems like a innocuous request from the Department of Health, and if you want to ask them to work better to get people to quit smoking, I think that's an admirable desire and something the state should really, really do.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I think the average 5-year-old knows that smoking's bad for him. So it's not that we're going to hand him a sheet of paper that says, did you know smoking's bad for you? What the issue is, and what I think some of the folks on the front lines would tell you, is that a lot of folks, either by not knowing that the programs are there or not being able to hook them up with non-smoking programs, because we don't ask the question when you sign up for public assistance, are you a smoker or are you not a smoker? And I think common sense would dictate that we should try to find out and then get them the information of there are nonprofits and community groups that are out there, and our hospital sponsors a lot of these, by the way, and there are products available from drug companies in many cases that they donate to places and try to get people hooked up. As I said, the average 5-year-old knows smoking is bad for them. So I think, you know, that's kind of silly if we're just going to hand them a sheet of paper saying smoking is bad. But I think to try to actually link them up by identifying the need, when you sign up, are you a smoker or non-smoker, and not test them or make them do oral swabs or any of that kind of invasive thing, but just let's try to bank on human honesty. And if you check the yes box, you can have the caseworker try to get that person informed about smoking cessation programs. And if we want to incentivize it by saying your payments are going to be lower, like what my bill does, or you just want to have the information available and try to aggressively pursue pushing them into that, fine. But I think there's some merit in us trying to do something that's better than what we do today.
Representative Nelson.
I guess I applaud that sentiment, but I guess the question I have found right now, you're saying I also have a libertarian streak, and I guess that's what I'm worried about here. You're saying about that it's our money that we give to them and we should be able to tell them how to spend that. How is that different than a state employee or a legislator who our money comes from, our salary comes from the state dollars, being able to say to an employee, well, you have to do this, this, or this. You have to spend your money this way because it's state dollars. The state should be able to dictate what you can and cannot use your money on.
Right.
I mean, I have a little problem with that line of logic you have there. What's to prevent other employers from saying, I give you this check, so you got to spend your money on this, and telling people, dictating to people how they have to spend their money on different things.
Right. Great question, Representative Nelson. What I would say is two things. Number one, in the state of South Dakota, if you're a state employee, you pay $10 more per pay period if you're a smoker, if you're a state employee. We don't do that in Minnesota, but they do that in South Dakota. So there is a different expectation for smokers, for state employees in other states. We don't have that in the state of Minnesota, but they do that in other states. The second one is, I would like to think we work for our money. I would like to think that the people who are at the colleges and that are upstairs cleaning the floor and the people who are out putting the street signs up work for their money. That's the difference. I know that's harsh for me to say that, but people who are MFET and general assistance and some of these things are not working for the money that they're getting from the taxpayer. And that's when I go to my town meetings, people are saying there should be more of an expectation for people who are getting government money. So that's the difference. So we'll have our libertarian votes on the floor as time goes on. I hope, you know, we have the 9-year-olds in car seat mandate bill that you'll join me in voting that down. But everybody's got a different ideology of what a libertarian probably is. But if there were not expectations on tax dollars, you'd be able to take food stamps and go to the grocery store and buy some of these products with that. But we've made a conscious decision That's not a good thing. The governor had a proposal 2 years ago. You shouldn't be able to buy junk food with your food stamps. So we got swatted down by the federal government, didn't we? But when I went to my town meetings and to talk to constituents, I didn't have one person who thought that was a bad idea. Now, my constituents may be different than your constituents, but I didn't have anybody in my district who thought that was a dumb idea. They thought it was a good idea. And we got swatted down by the feds, but that's the difference in my opinion, Representative Nelson.
Representative Nelson?
Well, I guess using that line of logic, to me, it's almost this bill could be labeled that poor people are stupid. We have to tell them how to live their lives. You know, I give my kids an allowance, and it's their money once I give it to them, and I don't always like the decisions they make with when they spent it, and I don't give them allowance anymore because they're above that age, but the idea behind that is to give them that money to help them learn how to spend, how to make wise decisions, and sometimes that's, to do that, you have to make dumb decisions to buy stupid things and realize that was pretty stupid to spend my money on. I guess what's next are we going to do on this? Are we going to then say, ask them, do you wear your seatbelt? Because it's proven that they're saying that it's a health hazard and it causes more accidents if you don't wear your seatbelt. Do you speed? Do you, any number of things that we could add onto this to ask the people and require them that you have to do this, this, and this, and if you don't, we're going to charge you a higher health premium on it. I just have problems with this. I guess that's where I'm coming from on it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, it's not about that. I know people want to say, well, we're going to get into all these other issues. That's not what the bill is about. If you stay within the constraints of the bill is about what you see. And as I said, I'm willing to work with people to change the bill and take the punitive side out and take the penalties out and work towards incentivizing. I think Representative Mahoney said he's open to that, as you, I think you are too. But my kids aren't old enough to give an allowance to because she's only 2 years old, but I guess if I have a 14-year-old and they're doing work in exchange for an allowance, that's great. But if I had a 14-year-old and I gave them an allowance and I found out that they were buying booze and cigarettes and porn magazines and everything else with it, I'd probably say, you know what? I'm not sure that's a great idea as a parent. But I'm not pretending to be these people's parents, number one. But number two, I think that if you look at what I've discussed this morning, if you take the penalties out, you identify when people come in, are you a smoker or not, without any consequence other than the fact that we're going to give you information on smoking cessation. We're going to do it on a pilot project level with maybe a couple rural counties in a metro city or something. I think an average reasonable person would say that's a pretty good compromise. Let's do a couple pilot projects and let's take all the penalties out and let's see if we can help folks a little bit.
Representative Clark.
I'm going to move my chair around here because we have a new member of the committee that's coming.
Okay. Ah. Ex officio, I assume.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slaughter.
I'm sorry, we're going through the third day of our water main break at our school.
And
it's a day-by-day thing, so I thought we'd do a learning experience today, so I appreciate the opportunity.
Would you like to state your name for the record? No, really, it's cool. You can talk into it. Nobody will hear you. Okay.
Tori.
Well, Tori, thanks for coming. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're going to really get smart here. We need some of these.
I think the average intelligence of the committee just went up.
I agree.
Do you know that smoking is bad for you, Tori?
I'm really glad you're here, Tori.
Did the Department of Health to tell you smoking is bad?
Oh, no. Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm just trying to figure out, Representative Seifert. You said a whole bunch of things that basically trashes your bill. You basically said to us, disregard your bill. Do you have an amendment for us today to look at?
Representative Sefford.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I don't have one yet because there was no fiscal note that was prepared in time for the bill. For me to see if I could get an idea of what these smoking cessation programs may cost or what the partnership and so forth might be. I don't think that I trashed my own bill. What I'm trying to do is to recognize the reality that for us to start something, You have to start in baby steps. And I think by doing a pilot project that is maybe in a couple counties that takes the penalties out but gives people information is a way to do it. Now, I don't have that in the form of an amendment, but I'd be happy to try to put something together for the committee to look at a little bit later. I'm trying to gauge what the committee wants, basically, Mr. Chairman. Instead of going to each of you in your offices and spending a lot of my time, I'd like to find out if the committee, in an honest dialogue, thinks that this something like this is worth pursuing, or is the status quo okay? I think that we need to push the envelope sometimes on responsible behavior with the taxpayers' dollars. And not pretending that people are dumb, I think that's insulting, but just acknowledging that human beings have weaknesses and addictions and that bad things happen, and we're going to try to rectify that. The stick in the bill is the co-pays, obviously. The carrot in the bill is the cessation program. I'm telling the committee, I'm fine taking out the penalties, but I think it is unreasonable for us as a group to say, if we could find a couple counties willing to do this, and we can find some nonprofits and a couple regional centers that are willing to do some cessation programs, let's try to do that. Now, I don't have a delete all or anything, but I'd be happy to work with everyone over here. And Representative Mahoney and I are in GovOps way too much together. I'd be happy to send some language over to him to look at.
For our next one.
But we're trying to come up with an idea of what is acceptable to the committee. And Representative Clark, you have more experience on this committee, I think, than any other member. I'm just looking around the room right now. If I could find something that's acceptable to you, I bet it would be unanimously approved in the legislature. I mean that in all sincerity. And there were reforms put in place back in my first term that Representative Greenfield and Representative Dorn and Representative Jennings all agreed to that I thought made common sense. Some of them you agreed with and some of them you did not agree with. But what I'm trying to do is come up with some ideas that the committee has that they find acceptable and unacceptable. What I'm hearing from this side of the table is the penalties are not acceptable, but I haven't heard about the partnership with nonprofits and the information, for example, prenatal programs and things. Is that something that we're willing to look at or not? So it's maybe a question back to you. But if the short answer is no, I don't have a delete all.
Representative Clark, you should follow up.
Well, Mr. Chair, I heard you say to the people that are going to address this bill, they should address what you're verbally saying you want to have us consider rather than the actual bill that's been here since, what, February 10th. I mean, if you really are serious about having a major gutting of this bill and coming back with a bill that just says we want to promote smoking cessation for pregnant women, I think is what I heard you say, and other vulnerable populations, I mean, this bill would look very, very different.
Sure.
And it wouldn't be that hard to write that kind of amendment. I bet you we could write it in about 10 minutes. I mean, it's very simple what you're talking about. I'm just trying to understand and looking at the bill what the carrots are in here. There's no incentive in here that I can see. Did I miss it? Did you have some incentive in here?
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chairman, the incentive would be for you to be enrolled. You've got the smoking cessation program on line 19, just looking at page 1, for example, if we're going to take a look at medical assistance, rather than just cutting people off, which is what some of my original town meeting people would like to do, we're given the option of going to smoking cessation. But what I did say, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, is that for the testifiers to come forward, testify on the bill and what we've talked about. If you find the bill unacceptable, tell us. If you like the bill, tell us. And if you've got some ideas for reform, tell us. But I think to do absolutely nothing isn't the right thing either. If we want to go all carrot and no stick, that's the committee's purview. But I think it's worth having the discussion on this, to at least try to do something, and I will try to do the work to come up with something. But this is probably not going to do well, I'm assuming. And I want to work with the DFLers to come up with something that they think is acceptable. I don't know that I want to put the staff on the spot of whipping something together. The bill's going to be laid over, Mr. Chairman, anyway.
Oh, okay.
And what I would ask for, is for the committee's input on what they think is a good idea and what they think is a bad idea, as well as the testifiers. If you guys think this is a bad idea, and I think you do, you need to tell me.
Well, Mr. Chair, it sounds like you think it's a bad idea. I mean, you basically.
No, I would move this forward, Mr. Chairman, and vote for this on the floor without hesitation. But I think there are other people uncomfortable with that. I'm not sure on both sides of the aisle. I think I have a lot of folks on my side of the aisle that think this is a great bill. I don't find a lot of DFLers who think it's a good idea. And recognizing that there are 68 people over across the street that need to pass something. Reality dictates that you do something different if you're a good legislator. But I'm not saying I'm ashamed of the bill. I'm just saying I'm recognizing reality that let's try to find a different way of doing it. And on a pilot level, trying to get something put together.
Representative Clark, before I call on you, if we could have the two testifiers, Ms. Bell and Gaboy, come down to the table just to, so we're...
Well, Mr. Chair, I was hoping we could hear from the Department of Human Services as well.
Is there anyone from the Department of Human Services who'd like to testify on behalf of this bill? Or against this bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm asking them to testify whether they like it or not. I would like
to. Do you have here there?
Is there someone?
In the spirit of Representative Seifert, they do work with the taxpayers.
I'm Ann Sessoms from the Department of Human Services.
Thank you. I'm just wondering what the department thinks of this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have analyzed the bill, and I can speak for the cash and the food programs only, not for the medical program. But for the cash and food programs, it's our analysis that this would be allowable under the federal TANF regulations, but that we would need a waiver in order to apply it to MFIT because of the food support. And that I guess in our estimation, it's unlikely that the food stamp feds would approve it, but we don't know that for sure. But it's because of the sanctions in the bill. There are MFIP sanctions. I know we've only been talking about the co-pays, but there are MFIP sanctions in the bill as it's written.
Representative Clark, any follow-up?
Yeah. So how easy or how hard would it be to do this, to implement it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, assuming that the federal government approved the waiver,
well, maybe could you just say what kind of waivers would be needed?
Okay. We would, Mr. Chair, Representative, the department would need to seek waivers of both the food stamp, federal agency, and for health care. And I don't really want to speak to health care. There is someone here who can if we need to go there. I know it's not in this committee. So if the federal government approved the food stamp waiver, then we would need to go about trying to implement. And I think there are a number of things in the bill that would need to be clarified before we could implement it. It doesn't describe how we would select the random sample, how large that random sample would be, and that would affect a lot of programming on the computer system.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
Do you have an estimate of what that might cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the fiscal note, as I understand it, is not complete yet. And in my experience, the way that it is likely to be approached is that if we need to seek waivers of the federal government, they will indicate that there is no cost or savings because we don't know whether or not we're going to get it. And so it wouldn't be until we had that approval that complete estimates would be given about what it would cost administratively to implement. I think some of the administrative implications are at the local level as well, which probably would not be included in our fiscal note.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Clark.
Just to try to understand that last part of what you said, the cost would be at a local level. In other words, the counties would be picking up the cost of doing whatever sort of...
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, yes. At the state level, we would need to do the programming. We would need to design the notices, the software changes. But at the local level, we would need to change the forms. And at the local level, they would need to do sort of the screening and make the referrals, determine where the... appropriate nonprofits or healthcare facilities were that they could refer individuals.
Thank you. Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Seifert, I want to applaud you for thinking outside the box
in this particular issue and bringing it forward for discussion. But I do have a question as far as it appears to me that the two requirements are, one, they either do not smoke or they're currently enrolled in a program. And I'm sorry, I didn't miss your earlier testimony, but what if they've enrolled in the program but it hasn't been successful? Did you address that?
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chairman, basically what the bill assumes is that you have to complete the program. The success rate varies. It depends on if there are, as I said, patch gum drugs that are used or just counseling. If you have counseling only without any other help, it's not going to be very successful. But as I said earlier, the penalty part of this bill is something that I would drop off. And in talking to the chair, or the vice chair, I guess it would be, the bill is being laid over for several reasons. One is to try to get a delete-all that reflects the input that I've gotten over on this side of the aisle from some of the and from the department and from some of the constituency groups, to try to do something on a pilot project level that takes out the penalties but moves people toward cessation programs that are nonprofits or hospitals or whatever. And we don't have a fiscal note. Representative Clark, that's another reason that's being laid over, is we don't have it completed. We requested one about 10 days ago. But being that we don't have that, I think it would do well for me to come up with the delete all in working with people. And quite frankly, we could probably move it on its own, or we could have it be put into the omnibus bill or whatever. But the cessation program is to be completed, but it doesn't necessarily have to be successful. At least that's what my intent is.
We have two additional testifiers, Ms. Bell and Ms. Is it Gavoy, if they have any comments they'd like to offer briefly, please.
And I'll be brief, Mr. Chair, and wrap up about 5 seconds, because I know you have a really lengthy bill after this one, and so my wrap-up is about 5 seconds.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. Please state your name. Go ahead.
Good.
Oh, come on.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Lyndon Galboy. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee, and I'll be testifying for Trishla as well.
Thank you.
We're going to share the testimony. I'm here to speak against House File 955 and lay out a few reasons why we're against the bill. First and foremost, it is discrimination against poor people. If you're going to go after one smoker, go after all. Go after state department heads who smoke, state patrol officers who smoke, smokers who use our state highways and other state services, veterans who smoke, jobs the funding recipients who smoke, and of course, legislators who smoke. Try doubling their medical cost sharing and co-pays, and try to take 10% of their salaries, like this bill, as it stands now, aims to do to us. Second, smoking is an addiction, a health problem. No one likes to be addicted, and it is well known that most smokers have to attempt to quit many times before success. Poor people who smoke already know they shouldn't. They don't want to smoke, and they certainly aren't smoking to stick it to the Minnesota state government. Third, in case you didn't know, tobacco is already taxed by this state. Smokers already pay into state coffers. Fourth, this bill mentions smoking cessation programs. We find this ironic, considering that the Tobacco Prevention Trust Fund was squandered to the tune of nearly $1 billion by the so-called budget balancing in 2003. Fifth, and I just added this after hearing the representative speak, MFIP and many people in Minnesota Care, we have worked, we're looking for work, we're hoping like hell to get a decent job, and to say that we don't work to pay taxes into a system for our safety net is an insult. If you're really concerned about the health of poor families in this state, then work to undo all the cuts to basic health services and basic survival income for poor people. A few ideas for this are to repeal the 5-year time limit on welfare, allow low-income parents to get an education that will lead to a decent job, get rid of the $5,000 cap on Minnesota Care and get rid of the co-pays, quit starving our public schools, undo the $50 per month MFIP grant cut to families in subsidized housing, and finally undo the $125 per month MFIP grant cut to families who are coping with disabilities. These cuts I mentioned cause damage to all poor families in Minnesota, and they're easy for the state to undo, especially if you use the revenue generated by closing the corporate tax loopholes, as is done by another bill that I hope will be heard in this committee, House File 1098. We don't need social engineering and ridiculous mean-spirited requirements that place the most ignorant sentiments of people. We need decent jobs, affordable child care, health care, and education. This is a bill that legislates discrimination, and we urge you to vote no.
Thank you. Representative Search, and then we'll have Representative Seifert wrap things up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seifert, you can stick all of what she said in your delete all. If you're taking the temperature, you'd have my support.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate your indulgence this morning. And I think we had a lot of good discussion on what may be common ground. Welfare reform has been something that we've been doing in the state for about the last 10 years or so. I think that we can come to common ground. Some of the best things that we did back in the late 90s was come up with pilot projects that are outside the box with willing partners on the local level, working with the departments. If we take the penalties out of this bill, and if we simply ask people when they sign up for a program, whether a smoker or not, and if they say yes, particularly for people in vulnerable populations like pregnant women, and we give them the information about a nonprofit in town and do everything we can to encourage them to move to a non-smoking status, I think that's a common ground that we can come up with. We had some good discussion this morning. Once we get a fiscal note in, I'll analyze that. And then what I would ask for is for the bill to be laid over. Give me a chance to work on something that that we can all come on common ground with. And there's one person who is probably a wizard of this place named Representative Gunther, who probably take bills that would either not pass or pass with 68 votes and turn them into 130 vote margins. I will be soliciting his advice a little bit when I work on this as well.
The wizard.
Wizard, not wizard.
Representative Wilkin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a comment. First, Representative Seifert, thank you for bringing the bill. It's a great idea, and for those of us who work on the health care side of things, I think it's very beneficial to bring this kind of initiative forward. I think my constituents, for one, can make a distinction between those who are receiving a check on welfare and those who are earning a check who are public employees, like state troopers or other state employees, that there's just a difference in the expectation. And when we're writing checks to welfare recipients, we expect that to be sustaining, life-sustaining funds that help them get by day to day and not use it for smoking. So I think it's kind of an insult to state employees to say that just because they're getting a state check, they should be subject to this too. That speaks to the last testifier. They're earning that check.
Representative Clark.
My goodness. I didn't have a question for Representative Seifert.
Sure.
This is amazing, all this discussion about... I want to thank Ms. Gabe for her testimony. I know that people on welfare work. They work hard, and they work at some of the toughest jobs, and they're getting training to work even harder at other jobs. And so I just... this kind of welfare and the trash, and I just don't appreciate it too much. But, Representative Seifert, I did have a question for you, which was, are you not aware, and I actually... ask for a document. We have a document here that reminds me that we already have smoking cessation programs covered by medical assistance. Are you aware of that? It's one of the things that is paid for. And so if you're not aware of that, I'd be glad to share this document with you. But both medical assistance and GAMC already pay for these programs. And if you're aware that the leader is going to say, let's do a better job of letting people know about that. That's one thing. But, I mean, this is not a new idea. People who are getting prenatal care, which I think is one of the groups that you care about, that I think we all care about, get a lot of information about smoking cessation. And even addiction, I think that's one thing I heard you say. I mean, it is a very, very difficult addiction. It's not... it's difficult. And I think we have people in this room who could tell us about, you know, how difficult that is and what a struggle it is. But I guess I just want to understand, I think you talked about losing the penalty in your bill makes it an incentive. We don't have that penalty in law right now, so that isn't the incentive. I think if you can come up with some other incentives, that would be along the line that was discussed, maybe removing some of the penalties. You know, people get lose $50 out of their small income check if they live in subsidized housing.
Representative Seifert.
So I think that there's some, you know, some real incentives that you could think about it, but I haven't heard yet.
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, the two main programs I was kind of looking at were MFIP and General Assistance. I wasn't aware of that, I'll be honest with you, and if you could get that information to me, I'd appreciate that. But I will be working with the department on finding programs that are not covered under this and moving it in. And I'm 5 minutes over what I thought I would be, so
Representative,
I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Seifert. Representative Clark, when she said there are some people that really had a hard time quitting smoking, she looked right at me. And I tried to quit smoking 99 times, and I don't consider myself a dumb person, but I know it's not good for me. But I smoked, and I still, after quitting for 3 years, walk by somebody smoking a cigarette and I want to have one. It is a very, very, very addictive habit. I would, I'm glad I quit, even though I gained 20 pounds. I think it was probably the hardest thing I've ever done to say that somebody's going to get penalized for smoking after knowing how hard it is to quit smoking. I think was a very stiff penalty for anybody to have to endure.
With that, Mr. Chair, lay it over, and we'll work with all the parties involved.
Okay. So once again, we renew our motion for House File 955 to be included in our omnibus bill.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you very much, Representative Seifert. Some testifiers.
Representative Westenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 659 be recommended to pass and referred to the Civil Law Committee.
Very well. Representative Tagovstein.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
There's also two author's amendments to get the bill in the shape that she would like. The first amendment is the A3 amendment, so I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Very well. That's your amendment. Would you please describe it for us?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A3 amendment basically just changes the effective date on the bill. In talking to the Department of Health and Department of Human Services, this would work best for their record keeping as far as the changeover with the technology and give a little bit more implementation time on the legislation. So I appreciate your support on A3.
Any discussion about the A3 amendment? Seeing none, Representative Westenberg renews his motion to have the A3 amendment amended. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. It's amended now.
Mr. Chair, and then also the A05-0243 amendment too.
Very well. Would you please explain that amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The 243 amendment is a result of talking to the Department of Health about some of the clarifications on working with a birth certificate, birth record for adoptive person, and the changeover with their records going paperless. And so it was felt that this is a more streamlined approach and more specific to the bill, so I appreciate your support.
Very well. Any discussion about that amendment? Seeing none, Representative Westenberg renews his motion to have the 0243 amendment adopted. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and Representative Westenberg. Appreciate that. Members, this bill is a bill about adoption, and the rights of people who are adopted and at least age 19 to have access to their birth record, their birth certificate. I really see this as a civil rights issue. Right now, this group of people is the only group of people not allowed to see their original birth certificate. Members, this bill has 72 co-authors. There's this legislation and two clones. So more than half of the House of Representatives are co-authors on this bill. And when Representative Garofalo was chairing the committee, I was noticing some things with him being a member of the freshman class. And one of the things we go through in freshman class, and I notice there's several in here have gone through the training that I've offered here the last 6 years, we talk about where the bill idea comes from. And it can come either through an agency or through a governor's initiative, through an idea on your own. Well, this one comes from, I think, the most important origination. It comes from volunteers. It comes from people who are affected by the legislation, by our state laws. And I've really been drawn into the stories and the compassion for the need to change this law. So you'll hear in a few minutes from those people. Today I'm just a messenger. Let them tell you why they think the law that affects them needs to be changed. In talking to legislators, and this group has been working very diligently over the last 2 months, a group of total volunteers, it's people who are birth parents, people who are adopted themselves, or people who are adoptive parents. And anybody who knows anything about adoption knows that that's the triad, all three parties involved in adoption, very grassroots effort. Now, there will be some opponents to this bill, and I have all the respect for them, and I've worked with them actually on various pieces of legislation through the years. But I want you to just keep in mind, listen to the stories of the people affected. Through the years, I have chief authored various pieces of legislation, and actually it's sort of ironic that I'm sitting in this chair right now, because I was here about 16 years ago as a volunteer, as somebody who wanted to adopt a child and saw that our laws needed to be changed. At that time it was an issue of independent adoptions versus agency adoptions, and as a volunteer I helped to change those laws. I worked with then Representative Kathleen Blatz, who was the chief author of our legislation. And so it's ironic how history repeats itself. Here I am again with legislation that adoption agencies, not all of them, some of them, adoption agencies don't necessarily like. And I'm willing to work with them. I'm willing to do more amendments on the bill. But you need to hear their side of the story as well. One of the biggest things I learned with working with then Representative Kathleen Glass was, look at the best interests of the child. Whenever it comes to adoption issues, the best interests of the child should prevail. In this legislation, we're dealing with adopted people who are over age 19. And actually, the legislation here today affects people whose adoptions occurred 20, 30, 40 years ago, when things were more closed and more confidential. Now those people are parents and grandparents, having children and grandchildren of their own, wanting more information about medical history, about where they came from, about their genetic past. And let's see, I want to just walk through a couple things here. But I guess, you know, my main point in my opening comments is, whose birth certificate is it? Please keep that in mind as we go through the legislation here. Members, I have some information in a packet that you received. There's several pages with it. Talks about the majority of birth parents that want contact, the importance of honoring the non-disclosure form filed by birth parents in the past, and we will honor that non-disclosure that birth parents have wanted. There's a sample relinquishment papers. You'll hear things today about what was promised, what was state law or not. I say to you that many things were verbal only, not written. Many things were based on nosy neighbors not wanting to know about a pregnancy, not about 20, 30, 40 years later when this birth mother would like to potentially meet that child and vice versa. And then page 4 of my packet here is a contact preference form that New Hampshire is now using. And my legislation is based on what's going on with other states and kind of gives you an idea with the contact preference form that would go into place and would offer the options of the birth parent being contacted, being contacted through an intermediary only, or preferring not to be contacted. And I repeat, that will be honored. And then also there's a chart of comparing the current state law with the projected law, as this is in House File 659. There's also a list of stories from people affected of why they think this law needs to be changed. A letter from a birth mother on page 8, and I think that's very strong. The opponents will bring up a birth mother as well, but keep in mind that we think only about 10% of birth mothers will want to remain private, and we do want to honor that. But there's a whole 90% out there that could potentially be meeting their children and grandchildren. And also letter support, and I actually have a whole packet of letter supports, and many of you have received things through your mail or email through the years. And then finally, on the back page, a list of groups, individuals that are supporting this legislation. And actually statewide, this group of volunteers has been very active in getting the message out. And in fact, one of the things you hear from my opponents is that this is part of a nationwide effort to do some things that a nationwide group is organizing. Let me tell you, this group of volunteers I'm working with are not associated with any nationwide group. They are strictly a grassroots group who are advocating on behalf of themselves. They are not affiliated with a national group. And they have so much compassion for this need for the law change that they are very active, and they're motivating other people to become active with emails and letters. So with that, I don't want to take much of the committee time myself. There is the bill summary. I could go through that, but I'd rather give my time to the people that are affected. As I mentioned, I'm just a messenger here. Try to remember whose birth certificate is it. So with that, I have a list of people who would like to testify on the pro, and then you're going to take the con, and then we'll move the bill.
I think in total we have 9 people that want to testify, and we have to leave a little time for members to have questions. So we have a very, very limited time. So if everyone would respect the other one's right to testify and speak for just a couple minutes, it would be very much appreciated. With that, Representative Bradley, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Because I may not be able to stay to the end, President Timmerstead, I am on the bill, and I think you're absolutely right that the vast majority of people would be fine with allowing access. But on the other hand, it is important in this body that we protect the rights of the minority who may choose otherwise.
I agree.
And although I see it in here about what's called affidavit of non-disclosure previously and so forth, it's not clear to me how this is sort of really made very clear to people so that that access to that choice, if that's their choice, is clear. Could you just elaborate just a little bit on that piece? Because I think it's pretty fundamental on what opposition I've had from some of my constituents.
Representative Tinglestead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley. Actually, it relates to what's on page 4 of the packet, and there would be a statewide public relations campaign done between now and the effective date that we just put on here of January 1st, 2006. And so people would know about the availability of filling out this contact preference form. And so through that means people would become aware of it and, fill out the forms and work with the adoption agencies on things related to that. And I don't know if you're looking for a specific wording in the bill. I don't have it right in front of me here, and perhaps counsel can help on this. And I do have some people who have worked diligently on this bill, so they could probably point out the exact page and line.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe we can break it into 2 pieces. If this process is in effect, looking forward when adoptions happen, does the process then include something that that people can indicate their preference of non-disclosure? And then we can talk about the past, but that one should be easier, I would assume.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley. Yeah, that's what's on page 4. This is one that's geared after New Hampshire. And with me is Mary Martin Mason, who's been a strong volunteer in this effort, and perhaps she can give you a more specific answer.
There's two pieces of paper. There's an affidavit of a non-disclosure that has been on file for many years where their friends could choose either an affidavit of disclosure or non-disclosure. We just learned from the Department of Health that of about 15,000 affidavits, 10% are on file for non-disclosure. So that means that the vast majority of their parents, you know, have indicated that they do want contact. Up until the passage of this bill, we will honor that affidavit. It's already on file. We do want to see if the birth parent is deceased, and if they still, you know, in case an adoptee comes forward and wants the information, we're going to check that out. What we do, though, at the point of the legislation passing, is that it would be replaced by the contact preference form, because that's a form that we have found works in other countries and other states, and it has been very successful, and also speaks to the changing practice in adoption, which is openness and people knowing one another.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps.
I think the first testifier, I think you've indicated, is Gretchen Taylor. Would she come up, please? And on deck, you have Sandy, how do you pronounce that?
Thank you.
Spraza, I believe.
Right.
Would you please give your name for the record before you testify?
My name is Gretchen Taylor. I'm an adoptee and an adoptive parent of an adult adoptee. Mr. Chairman and representatives, in 1989, after a lifetime of illness with severe lung disease initiated by premature birth, I learned that my lungs were damaged severely enough that I needed a lung transplant. I tried unsuccessfully 15 years earlier to contact my birth mother through a placement agency. The family member received just one sentence through the social worker. She had a brain aneurysm at age 60, but this was not hereditary. I was determined not to undergo such a serious procedure as lung transplant without current or complete medical information. As the agency's fees had more than doubled by that time, I decided to attempt a court order to open my records. Despite the urgency of my need, the time for clinical appointments with a pulmonologist came and went without medical information. My primary care physician showed my deep concerns about going to transplant and the complicated aftercare involved without medical, genetic, and health information, so I opted out of the transplant process. I retired from my teaching position of many years in hopes that this would improve my health enough to avoid transplant in the future. After finally receiving a court order, I was able to contact some birth relatives. I learned that contrary to my birth mother's original statement, her form of brain aneurysm is indeed hereditary, and that several other life-threatening conditions exist in both sides of my family. My situation is not unique. I am just one of an increasingly aging and medically needy adopted community. For example, Michael Tedderman is hearing impaired, a condition caused by his birth mother's having contracted rubella during her pregnancy. Efforts to get his medical and birth information have failed, leaving him to struggle with lifelong medical complications. Excuse me. When my husband and I adopted our son, they deliberately chose his country of birth with the limited availability of his medical and health information. We were determined that he would never be faced with the obstacles I and so many others have had to deal with as adult adoptees. Today, we know that over 4,000 diseases have a genetic link. Many adopted persons give birth to children who in turn have a medical history on that side of their families, and so on through all born generations. The current system fails adoptees and their descendants through its cost, paperwork burdens, lack of timely resolution, and reliance on outdated and incomplete, if not incorrect, information. In today's world, open records is a matter of life and death. Please vote yes on Senate File 1005. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next we have Sandy Spraza. Please give your name for the record. Remember, we have seven behind you.
Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the Judiciary of the Committee. My name is Sandra Spraza, and you have my relinquishment form in front of you. Nearly 44 years ago, as a scared 17-year-old, I signed the document before you, giving my only daughter up for adoption. And if you'll take note on that, in fact, I give consent to release information about me to anybody that they chose. There was never any secrecy promised then. The legal consequences of that action I have persisted through time, while adoption practices have completely changed to what is now open adoption. I have been the branch coordinator for CUB, Concerned United Birth Parents, for over 33 years. In that capacity, I've had the privilege of hearing the personal stories of hundreds of birth parents and adopted adults. It is with this unique perspective, as both a birth mother and an advocate for all parties of the adoption triad, that I come before you today to ask that you give birth mothers of old the same opportunities and dignity as birth mothers of today. I come to give voice to the birth mother. I am the voice of the birth mother from the 1910s, 1920s, and 30s, who were evicted from their homes, kicked out of school, fired from her job, simply because she found herself pregnant without the benefit of marriage. She was either sent off to some distant relative or sent to a laying-in hospital or maternity hospital, where she stayed for 3 months nursing and caring for her newborn. During this time, she worked at the facility to pay for her medical and lodging expenses. How would society perceive these actions if they occurred today? I am the voice of Marie from Mendota, who after delivering her only child was labeled feeble-minded and involuntarily sterilized. 60 years later, she was reunited with her only child. When I spoke with her, she said, "Before I would go to sleep at night, I prayed that God would send me my son before I die." Even though Marie and her son had 5 wonderful years together, it can't erase what was done to her. But we can begin that journey of healing today with your support. I am the voice of Pat, a 94-year-old birth mother who said she was so relieved to finally, from carrying that burden that of the secret for 56 years, she could hardly wait to meet her only daughter, also an artist and a writer. I am the birth mother of the 40s, 50s, and 60s who was sent off to an unwed mother's home away from friends and family. She was not allowed visitors other than immediate family and was given an alias by the staff at intake for fear that someone at some future date might blackmail her. She was sent to the hospital to labor alone, and sometimes pain medication was withheld during labor so that she would think twice before she got herself in this predicament again. She was sent to the delivery room where often her eyes were covered, the mirror draped, and the baby whisked away so she would not see. Sometimes mothers were not told the sex of the child they had delivered, the theory being that somehow this would make the loss easier to bear. During the 50s, 60s, and 70s, women who were given up children were routinely given a drug called twilight sleep. This consisted of scopolamine, which causes amnesia, and morphine, which is a combination sedative and hypnotic. With your help, we have the opportunity to remove that veil of secrecy and shame that surrounded the adoptions of these years and bring them into the openness and honesty that is characteristic of today's adoption. I am the voice of the birth mother who has gone before me, never knowing if her child is dead or alive. I am the voice of the birth mothers who have carried the burden of this terrible secret for 60, 70, or more years. I am the birth mother, like Lucille, who 3 days ago from her nursing bed in a convalescent home asked, "Is he handsome?" She just wanted to know now, at age 90, what happened to the son she gave life to in 1930 and saw when he was 3 months old. I am appealing to you to give Lucille the opportunity to meet her son with the unnecessary restraints of old. I'm a mother, like your mother, your grandmother, your sister, your wife, like any mother who loves her child. The birth of our children is seared into our memory and our hearts. Like any mother, we do not forget the children we carry to term and labor to deliver. Our opponents may say that birth parents do not want to know the children we place for adoption. My many years of experience tells me this is not so. You will hear that birth parents are afraid to be reunited with their children, and this fear is a reason to keep the record sealed. Of course, it is true that birth parents could be apprehensive to open the door to the past. In the light of what you've heard,
Why wouldn't they be frightened? But just because this journey to the unknown is difficult, it does not mean that they would rather deny a son or daughter access to the records of their birth if they so choose to access them. Please allow the children we place for adoption the opportunity, if they wish, to make an outreach to their ancestry, their health history, their beginnings in this world. Please allow birth parents the right to share those special gifts with their offspring. Please allow me the gift of forgiveness, the gift of knowledge, healing, resolution, and peace that all birth mothers deserve and can achieve through passage of this legislation. If we made the decision to carry our child to term, to endure the hardships of the adoption process, and loved our children enough to place them with a family who could offer what we thought would be a better life, then doesn't it stand to reason we would love them enough to want them to know their unique story of their birth? You will hear today of how accounts of unplanned pregnancy was dealt with in the past. We now know that our approach of old, while considered appropriate at the time, was in fact misguided. As a society, we have corrected those mistakes, but we still have some unfinished business. Continuing the practice of sealed adoption records harkens to an era that is no longer relevant. Please allow all adoptees to make the choice to support, to have access to their birth records, and I would appreciate your support.
Thank you. Mary Mason.
Mr. Chairman and Representatives, my name is Mary Martin Mason. I'm an adopted person, an adoptive parent, and an author. I work for Minnesota Adoption Resource Network, a 25-year-old organization that advocates for waiting children and sibling groups in need of family. Most of you know it as Thursday's Child. In 3 weeks, I will keynote the largest adoption conference in New England and do a one-day training for adoption professionals. I also do trainings locally for Minnesota's largest free private adoption agencies, Children's Home Society and Family Services, Lutheran Social Service, and Catholic Charities. My task is to educate birth and adoptive families who are entering into fully disclosed adoption using my life experience of having grown up in an open adoption, as has my 19-year-old son. All major agencies in this state offer open adoption in their infant programs because, frankly, that's what birth mothers want. Open adoption presents such a positive option for pregnant women unable to care for a child that in a recent Wall Street Journal article, it noted that there were more babies than couples available through agencies that have a history of doing fully disclosed adoption, a demographic not seen in 30 years. My message in New England and also to you today is this. Adoptive parents and birth parents need not fear one another. Disbanding secrecy and sharing identities benefits everyone, particularly the adoptee, whether they are children or adults. In 2004, as part of my job, I personally answered 169 search-related calls. Almost half of them were from adoptive persons caught up in the red tape of this current system, 20% from birth parents, 13% from extended family members, especially siblings looking for siblings. A third of those calls complained about the adoption system obstacles and costs, and 6% cited immediate medical concerns. Among the many adoption support groups that champion this effort and have joined in this grassroots effort is Reuniting Minnesota, since its inception in 2000, has fielded nearly 1,000 calls for search assistance. Among the many search calls that I continue to take, I notice a demographic that's evident on my face as well as the faces of those present today. We are an aging population for whom every delay represents lost time. Our opposition has for many years used a delaying tactic to assure that most birth parents will die. The flaw in this ultimately harms the very population it claims to protect. We, the aging children of adoption and the presumed reason for the adoption, are marginalized and discounted. As children, we had no voice, signed no papers, or denied the very paper that introduces us to the world. We are not shameful, we are no one's secret, and the majority of our birth parents, as just evidenced by the health department statistics regarding the affidavit of non-disclosure, do not view us as such. When we adopted our son in 1986, we learned that his birth mother, Lisa, was also adopted. Her paperwork became his paperwork. Five sentences on a piece of paper. Later, we learned that three of those sentences were fabricated by a well-meaning social worker with the good intention of getting her adopted. It was only in a reunion that these truths would be revealed, as well as pertinent medical history. Both Lisa and her birth mother had an early hysterectomy due to cancer. This four-generational reunion was not that one-time happy meeting that you see on TV. It was just a one-time meeting that will not be repeated. This is not a bill about reunion. It is a bill about the opportunity to gain life-important and, in some cases, life-saving information. Our senator author, Senator Ann West, characterizes this bill as a true moral dilemma with valid points to be made on both sides. Representatives, as you contemplate which side to choose, consider the positive impact, not just on this generation that is directly affected today, but on generations in the future. I urge you to vote for the greater good, restoring the most basic of human rights to adopted persons and the hope of healing that has been eroded through secrecy and shame.
Thank you very much. In order to make sure we have both sides heard equally, we'll ask Connie Roller to come in, and if we have time, we'll have the other two testifiers from the pro side come up. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Hello, Chair. My name is Connie Roller, and I am a manager of adoption services with Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis. If you would allow me, Chair and members, I'd like to respond to Representative Bradley's question before I go on with my general remarks.
We have equal time for both, so you know what you're doing.
Well, my concern is the question about the affidavit of disclosure, non-disclosure, and a choice of a birth parent or an adopted person to refuse contact in the future. And once the bill is passed, if that date is 1106, at that point it becomes a preference. A contact preference. So it is a form that is not in any way an affidavit of non-disclosure. It becomes a preference. And I think that's just such an important part. It's certainly a part of why we as agencies are concerned about this particular bill. Thank you. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Connie Roller, and I represent 9 agencies. That is Bethany Christian Services, Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis, Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Crookston, Catholic Charities of the Diocese of St. Cloud, Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Winona, Children's Home Society and Family Services, Lutheran Social Services, St. Louis County, Public Health and Human Services, and Wellspring Adoption. And with that, the workers who provide service currently to birth parents, adopted persons, and adoptive parents. We have grave concerns about the passage of any legislation that would release confidential and identifying information about birth parents without birth parents' consent. This is the one part of the bill that we have concerns with. Changing that data classification from confidential to private, which would release information without consent. Adopted persons' right to access their original birth record is not a new issue. In 1977, Minnesota was the first state in the country to address this very difficult, complex, and painful issue by passing legislation with an intermediary-based model. Current Minnesota statutes that have been in existence for 28 years provide a fair consent base. And I want to say again, that's our concern, is that consent base way for adopted persons, birth parents, and adopted parents to request updated information and direct contact. Under current statute, adopted persons have the right to receive valuable medical information in agency records and to request and receive updated medical. In situations of documented medical need, fees are waived or reduced. And I think you'll hear more about that, the number of fee reductions and the desire of agencies to provide this service, whether or not a client can afford the fees. Adoptive persons, birth parents, and adoptive parents have the right to request contact with one another. The adoption agency facilitates a confidential search and outreach and provides intermediary services until each party decides to release identifying information. And you'll hear more on that, how the process can ease the consent and ease the contact preference and the contact in the future. Adoptive persons have the right to receive all non-identifying information about their birth parents and birth relatives from the agency's adoption record and to be notified if updated medical information about a genetic condition is received. Adoptive persons, if adopted after August 1, 1982, have the right to identifying information about birth parents named on the original birth record from the agency's adoption record unless an affidavit objecting to agency release is signed. Birth parents who made adoption decisions in this state prior to 1977 were told that the original birth record would forever remain sealed. To pass, House File 659 sends a very clear message that birth parents no longer have rights to their privacy, confidentiality, or to the decisions they've made in their life based on those early decisions. The birth mothers affected by the proposed legislation are those who made adoption decisions at a time when unplanned pregnancy carried great stigma and shame. We've heard a little bit about that. We acknowledge that. I think we as a society all feel a responsibility for that, too. Whether some now find these attitudes wrong or outdated, the fact remains that a promise of confidentiality was made. Adoption practices have made major changes. We've facilitated open adoptions now for over 10 years. And because of existing open adoption practices and laws that all agencies support and follow, identifying information about birth parents will not be an issue in the future. But birth mothers of an earlier era trusted our word. Trust that we will keep our word is an essential part of adoption practice today. Trust that is needed in order to preserve the option of adoption for all birth parents. Maintaining client confidentiality when promised and stated in statute is a trust we believe should not be broken. Now, you've been handed some information, some basic information that we as agency have, some letters. You also have the current DHS brochure that goes out to all people stating what the services are and are available to people requesting post-adoption services. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Linda Coleman.
Mr. Chair?
From Children's Home Society. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Linda Coolman. I'm a social worker at Children's Home Society and Family Services, and I was working for Hennepin County in the 1960s. My job is to seek information and facilitate contact between birth parents and adopted adults. Every day, I work with people who successfully reach out to each other and learn updated information about one another. In 99% of the cases in our agencies, the adopted adult receives, at a minimum, the updated medical information. And this booklet that you have is what we go over with the birth mothers to help them complete that so that their adopted person will have the necessary medical information that we all realize is so important. When I was working in the 1960s with birth mothers, I was there with them when they felt the harsh and judgmental nature of society. When they had to leave school, many times they were kicked out of their families. They had to leave town, go into maternity homes. It was an unbelievable world at that time. As social workers, we really missed the boat in realizing the importance of grief counseling for the birth mothers. And they went on with their lives in the best way they could, stuffing all those feelings, many times with low self-confidence and self-esteem, and many times going into marriages where they did not dare tell a husband they had placed a child for adoption. I'm here today for the 25% of the birth mothers that chose not to have direct contact. These are women who would never dare to appear in public to express their wishes. They were promised by everyone working with them, pastors, priests, social workers, that according to the statute at that time, their confidentiality would be protected and that the original birth record would stay sealed. The proposed legislation would remove the birth parents' rights to decide if, how, and when identifying information about themselves is released. I would like to read some of the statements from some of the birth mothers who were called under our existing laws. These words are from the very women who believed that their lives would be destroyed if you pass House File 659. One birth mother said, "My husband never knew this would be the end of my marriage. He would leave me and my children wouldn't want me to be their mother anymore." Another birth mother, "My husband married me in spite of my sin. I can't bring this up to him again. I can't remind him of what happened 36 years ago." Another birth mother, "I've prayed for forgiveness all my life. Please don't expose me now. I wouldn't be able to tolerate it. It would just kill me." Another one, "My husband who never knew is dead. I'm dependent on my son for my living, and if he knew, he would throw me out of the house. Where would I go? I am 79 years old." The current openness practices in adoption, which we all support, did not exist 30, 40, 50 years ago. The option to sign the affidavit of disclosure or non-disclosure that you've heard about regarding the release of the original birth certificate started in 1977. All the birth mothers who delivered prior to 1977 did not have that option. These are the birth mothers whose confidentiality would be destroyed. From 1977 on, birth parents were given the option about signing the affidavit and updating their information with the agency. Birth parents knew then that the adopted adult might initiate contact and that they also could initiate contact. Many birth mothers, as you've heard, who placed a child before 1977, born before 1977, welcomed the adopted adult's attempt to contact them also. But some are devastated. They made the decision that was right for them and for the child at that time. Many of their subsequent life decisions were based on assurance that their confidentiality would be protected. To retroactively change the agreement to safeguard their confidentiality without their knowledge or consent is wrong. There isn't any way that we could notify every birth mother who delivered prior to 1977 when they move all over the United States. So no matter what we did in Minnesota to publicize this, we couldn't reach all of them. Minnesota already has a law in place to provide access to information. We must not break our promise of confidentiality.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're up there. What's your... Are you a birth mother?
I am a birth mother.
Okay. Please make your testimony short. We've got a couple more people. Like
this is it.
I
right here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I gave birth to a baby girl in September 1973. My reasons for adoption were a child should have both a mother and a father, and I could not provide that for her. At the time I was 19, I was told that my records would never be available to her or anyone else. They were confidential. And I was glad of that for many reasons. Over the years, I thought of her constantly, but kept my vow never to interfere with her life. Because of her search, I was given the choice of meeting her. Children's Home Society guided her through a year or two of thought and preparation. It took us 6 months of counseling, letter writing, and talking with our families before we were ready to meet. And then another year and a half for us to introduce each other into one another's lives. Our families now share our children, our griefs, our goals, our daily life, and all that happens with an extended family. Our story is a success because of the current law. It is through caution, guidance, and with an open mind that we were successful. Reuniting adoptive children with their birth parents is not an exact science. It is not a God-given fact that everything will be okay
just because we are connected through birth. Medical information is not a reason to change the law. Medical information can be obtained easily enough, protecting the rights of both parties. My belief is based on my own experience and how the law allowed my story to happen. This law should not be changed. I hate the thought of a phone or a doorbell or a person with good intentions and little experience changing a life without allowing for some preparation on their part. Women base their choices on the information they were given. To change the law 25 or 30 years later is unfair. These women should be allowed the choice as I was. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Robert DiNardo.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert B. DiNardo. I'm an adoptive father, but I'm here primarily because of what I have learned over a 38-year career in the social service field. My experience includes 20 years at Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis, with six of those as supervisor of their domestic and international adoption program, and 15 years with the Minnesota Department of Human Services as supervisor of the Adoption and Guardianship Unit. Currently, I serve as a guardian ad litem for the Ramsey County and Dakota County District Courts. The underlying principle, serving the best interests of the child, has guided policy and decision makers for decades. Criteria for determining best interests has tended to be a mix of contemporary social issues, beliefs and assumptions of the time, and research. Over the extent of my career, I've witnessed the lifelong impact of decisions made on behalf of the child by caring, committed persons. Hindsight can be a great teacher, and one of the things I have learned is that too often decisions are made based on the concerns for the immediate and shorter-term interests and safety of a child without consideration of the longer-term or lifelong implications. Adoption practice and laws have been a perfect example of this phenomenon. Adoption practice was focused on establishing and enhancing the adoptive parent and child relationship and protecting the birth parent and child from the embarrassment of illegitimacy. Little, if any, thought was given in practice or statute as to what would serve that child's best interest as he or she grew to adulthood. It was widely believed that the adopted adults, the subject of adoption, who grew up secure in their relationship with their adoptive parent, would have little or no interest in their birth parents. That is not the case. Over the past 40 years or so, adopted adults have reminded us that, as with other human beings, they have significant interest in their heritage, knowing who one's birth parents are. Placing a name to the person, seeing their original birth certificate, is integral to a sense of connection and validity as a human being. The absence of this knowledge can have a profound lifelong effect. Minnesota recognized the importance of this issue to adopted adults and in 1977 established a process wherein, subject to their birth parents' approval, they could get a copy of their original birth record. Considered progressive at the time, it revealed two underpinnings of the adoption process. First, that the interest of the birth parent, not the child, was primary. Secondly, the adoption agency's clients are the birth parent and the adoptive parent, not the child. In effect, the adopted person, the subject and focal point of the adoption, the person whose best interests were sought, had no voice and no advocate. The legislation also highlighted the adoption agency's inherent conflict of interest in the adoption process. It required the adoption agency to be the intermediary between the interests of the birth parent and their adopted child. Yet, the agency's historic relationship with the birth parent made it a reality that the agency's sympathy lay with the birth parent. On top of this, the agencies are responsible for executing a process that is labor-intensive and expensive, and for which they receive no subsidies or grants. They rely on fees or contributions to fund services. For instance, when I was responsible for Catholic Charities Adoption Program, I was charged with raising the revenue to support the services. At best, we were able to finance them at the 50% level. The difference was incorporated into our overall adoption fee structure. Since the fees did not cover costs, these services remained understaffed, giving rise to many questions about the quality, timeliness, and sincerity of the service provider. I have come to believe that if we are to serve and protect children by making adoption decisions based on their best interest, we are then morally, ethically, and should be legally obligated to serve and protect their best interests as adults. I have come to believe that adopted adults, regardless of when they were adopted, must have access to their original birth records upon request. Not every adopted adult is going to be seeking that information. Adopted agencies should not have to struggle with their conflict of interest, but rather should be placed back into the position of offering programs and services to assist with the unique elements of adoption. I hope you will agree with me and seek your support in passage of House File 659. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we have two more testifiers that would like to speak. Members, I look for your direction. Would you rather hear the testifiers or would you rather ask questions to the people already here? Representative Clark?
Chairman, I'd like to hear the testifiers, I think. I'd be willing to stay.
Representative Gazelka?
I'll stay because I do have a question.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, can I point out something? The next hour, we have a huge hearing on the health finance bill, so you're going to start seeing lots of people coming in. I mean, that's just reality.
Okay.
So,
I think... There again, I look for the members' direction and the authors. We can lay this bill over, so we can lay it over for this committee and hear the rest of the hearing at another time, or we can vote, ask questions and vote on it. It's up to you. It's got to go to another committee, so we have to honor that. So I'm looking for direction. Representative Wilkins.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You know, I don't want to slow it down for the author if she's got a real long road, but I do have a lot of questions on this. It's not, I don't think, an easy subject for anyone around the table.
I totally agree.
So I think I'd rather take some more time.
So, Representative Surge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Tennis said, what is the movement in the Senate? What is the deadline ramifications of laying this bill over today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I would like to keep the bill moving. It does need to go to civil law, and then it will go to Representative Bradley's committee in the finance. So I think both of you are on that committee. In the Senate, it had a hearing scheduled a couple days ago. It was at the end of the agenda. They didn't get to it. So that hearing will be next Tuesday, and it needs to go to a couple committees in the Senate. So I'm not sure which of us will meet first deadline. I hope that it would be in the House. So we're just a couple weeks away there.
Yeah, Representative Clark.
Yeah, I actually agree with Representative Wilkin. I think we need time on this bill. Some of the testimony today was helpful. Mm-hmm. I've been a supporter of the bill. I have a few questions myself, and I would really think if we can take the time, I would be willing to have an extra meeting. I just think it's an important enough issue.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to work with members if we could maybe get a date certain. I know there's lots of people that are following this, and it's a little easier if we can get it on the calendar and help me move the bill towards deadline.
Yeah, we can lay this bill over and hear it first thing Tuesday morning.
Appreciate that.
Members, we will have to focus on Tuesday morning's agenda then, which I'm sure you've always rose to the challenge, and we can do that. So I sense that as the committee's desire to lay this bill over till Tuesday's meeting, and then we can hear the rest of the testifiers, is a very important issue, and I think it deserves our attention. So, with your permission, we'll lay this over till Tuesday morning. Thank you very much.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair members. Thank you for this hearing, and I'll be on the floor if anybody wants to talk to me today.
Representative Surdick.
Well, Mr. Chair, and just for members of the audience, if you're unable to come back again and you have internet access, you will be able to hear the audio at least, and maybe the video from your homes. If you go to the House of Representatives website, you can at least get the audio if you've traveled a far distance and can come back next Tuesday. So just go to the House of Representatives website, click on the Jobs Committee, and you can get the audio of us discussing this Tuesday morning.
Very good point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Appreciate it.
Don't forget to stuff all the information in the folders,
yeah,
in the save folder. And with that, we're adjourned.